Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome to the show. Welcome to Wednesday afternoon and Mr. Andrew Guy's birthday! Whammy! What a huge day! We're talking about one of his favorite movies of all time, 28 Days Later. This is Action Movie Anatomy. We'll see you guys in just a second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Oh, I thought we were listening to Still Dre for a second.
I know, right?
If this was like a remix, I would be so impressed.
I was like going to try to start rapping. I was like, there's no way that I should do this today.
Ha ha. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the show. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy. We're back. It's Andrew's birthday. Happy birthday, buddy.
Thanks, man. We are. Ben was very nice. He got me a little bit of some scotch here. You know, we're sharing some of that. We got my mother on the couch. The beautiful Sue Peck is hanging out. We don't have her mic today because she would take over the show as she always does when she's here. I don't think I've been more happy to like work on my birthday ever.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's exciting. Yeah, I guess this doesn't really feel like much of a job anymore.
No, it really doesn't. It's just like me and Ben get to hang out for, you know, a couple hours every Wednesday. 2 years later, and one of my absolute favorite movies of all time.
Would this make your top 50 if you had to guess?
100%.
100%.
Yeah, absolutely. No questions.
Yeah, I've been putting my list together. I'm stalled on 61 right now.
I've
cut a few things, but I'm having a really hard time getting it trimmed down. There's a few movies that I like really love that I think probably make the 50.
Uh-huh.
Like this movie I love, I don't think it'd be in my 50.
I can see that. I mean, there's things about this, and I'm super curious to talk to you about the third act falling apart now that we just watched it again recently and maybe see what the fans have to say and all that. It would be on the cusp for me. It's not like a for sure like top 20
10.
Or top 10,
yeah.
But I definitely think it's in the top 50.
It's a really great movie. I mean, I enjoyed it more this time through. I was struck by a couple things that I can't wait to talk about in the episode. So guys, this is Action Movie Anatomy. We talk about action movies here. I'm your host, Ben Bateman. You've got Andrew Guy, the birthday boy,
woo!
Over here, a big 24 years old, so congratulations to that.
I'm going to be able to rent a car next year. I'm really excited.
It's exciting. Yeah.
Thanks everybody in the chat for wishing me a happy birthday, and thank you to all those that watched Film Therapy with me and Brianne Chandler last week. Ben was actually on the week before me. So if you guys want, you can go watch the AMA boys back-to-back weeks on Film Therapy. It's a great episode.
Yeah, we had some good episodes. I'd like kind of poked some fun at myself, and then Andrew went like full on inside the actor studio.
Yeah, I went like full depressing. My mom's watched it like 5 times. She's like, every time I watch it, I cry. I'm like, perfect.
Yeah, I was basically, you were Downey Jr. and I was Stiller in Tropic Thunder in that situation. I tried to go full soloist, but I couldn't do it.
It's tough, man. It's definitely was tough.
Yeah, so it's a good reference there. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a great reference. I was thinking about it. I was processing it. I was like, that's impressive.
So, guys, we talk action movies on the show. This is, I guess, it's like a horror action movie. It does have a lot of action in it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and the pace feels very action-y.
However, it doesn't feel like one of our films that we cover on the show.
No, and I think it's pretty safe to say that over time we have sort of evolved out of the initial idea of what the show was originally going to be in terms of the type of movie we cover. The movie just has to be awesome and have like enough action for us to justify it.
Exactly.
But yeah, guys, this is the Popcorn Talk Network. You're listening to or watching the online broadcast network dedicated to talking about movies and all things movie related. The action movies we cover on the show adhere to four basic rules. So aside from being made after 1981, which is a soft rule that we are sure to break, maybe never. We always say we're going to.
It's so weird. We never have.
But aside from that, rule number one, the hero always plays by their own rules.
It's tough because, honestly, the real hero of this movie is Naomi Harris.
Yeah.
She's really the one that keeps everything together, drives the story. Yeah. Like, Cillian Murphy is kind of just the one that he's like our filter of the world.
Yeah, so it's definitely not one where it has an easy answer to that question. So I think it bucks that rule for sure.
Yep.
The hero and the villain are always the smartest people in the room. There's not really a hero that knows the most, and the villains are just these like rage zombies. So,
yeah, and then the villains, if you really had to place a villain on a person, it'd be Robert Eccleston, but that wouldn't be till the last act of the movie. So.
Raymond Calitri.
I like wood. Soft.
It's
like
watching.
It's like watching a baby being born.
If you want to watch him in an Oscar-winning performance, go watch God in 60 Seconds.
Rule number three, the movie is driven by a police, military, or political figure, or mercenary. None of those.
None of those.
This movie pretty much doesn't hit any of the rules, except for rule number four. The movie contains a minimum of one explosion.
Which costs,
a lot of money, and I forgot that it even happened.
Yeah.
Straight up. Didn't remember. There's a lot of things about this movie I didn't remember.
Yeah, it's so crazy. There is so much that happens in this film. It's like such a journey that there's parts that you definitely forget unless you watch it a lot. And that explosion cost £250,000 to make, and the crew had filled out all the necessary paperwork except letting the police know.
So, yeah, it caused quite the ruckus.
Quite the ruckus. Yes. And Danny Boyle had to deal with that for hours and hours.
I think, honestly, so you've probably seen this movie, what, 5-6 times? Maybe more?
Maybe 20.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah. This movie, I'll bet you I've seen this movie. This is probably the fourth time, third or fourth time.
Yeah.
And it had been easily 10 years. So, if I had to really think about it, what I remembered about this movie before watching it, I was, because each time a scene would come up that I, like, distinctly remembered, mm-hmm. I would note it and be like, oh, yeah, this is what I expected I was watching. There's a lot of stuff I forgot about. So, like, scenes that happened that I completely forgot existed. Number one, the intro where they break out the monkey. Totally forgot that existed.
Yeah, how'd you feel about that?
It almost feels, like, unnecessary.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, like, they took such an innovative approach with this film and not wanting to... I mean, it was the first time you saw zombies run and that, and, like, the thing that they talk... Well, the thing they talk about is that, like... They wanted these zombies to be so different than the other zombies. They didn't want it to be something where you died and came back.
Right.
They wanted it to be where rage infected your body and took over, like Ebola and all that.
Yeah.
So, like, it's one of those things where I didn't really ever know all that, or I didn't really even process all that.
Yeah.
I still, in my mind, because zombies have been so embedded in our culture for so long, it's been like, oh, it's a zombie, so it's got to die and it's going to come back to life. You got to kill the brain. So that scene, I think, misses just a little bit.
Yeah, that scene, that one I totally forgot about. I also forgot the fact that they take Jim out to execute him. I didn't remember that at all. I also didn't remember that the guys, that the military guys, are luring women in just to lure women in.
Yeah, they're assholes.
For some reason, in my memory, it was like they go there, and then it's like these guys can't be controlled because, of course, they can't be controlled because it's like men cooped up.
Right.
But it's not like – I didn't remember it being like this intentional plot.
Yeah, it was like we're going to kill ourselves, and he's the captain. How do we make these men want to stay alive?
Totally different point of view watching it this time. It's amazing the way you view movies. So
the only reason that that scene sticks out to me, the prior one of him getting executed, is because he sees a plane fly by.
Yeah.
And that's such a monumental part in the movie to where he's like the guy just says it beforehand, the guy that went crazy they just killed the other soldier, he's like it can't travel across the seas, you know he's like, they're just letting us kill ourselves on this island. So when you see the plane, you're like, holy shit, the rest of the world is just like,
that
part is haunting to me, I think, more than anything.
Well, it's also really weird. I mean, and we're gonna get into the whole thing, guys, but like, it's definitely pretty weird that this movie came out the same time or within a year as The Walking Dead comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And they open in almost the exact same way. It's a guy in a coma that wakes up from basically missing the entire outbreak in a hospital. And he wanders around, and then he, like, you know, happens upon the first zombie. It's like literally the same premise.
Yeah, and there's another film. I wish I could remember it. It's in the trivia, the Trina something. It's
okay,
like an old film, but it's like same thing. Guy wakes up. The only reason he made it is because he was isolated in a hospital.
Yeah.
Empty Britain, things like that.
So when you read the collected edition of Walking Dead Volume 1, there's a whole foreword written by Robert Kirkman where he's literally saying, I had written the script for this. This was already in development when 28 Days Later came out, and it was in no way related to it. This is just, it was just coincidence. And they came out so close to each other, people assumed that he essentially ripped off 28 Days Later. Because it's like a few years later.
Right, right.
So I thought that was so interesting because they do feel so eerily similar. But the big difference in the two worlds, of course, is that in Walking Dead world, we are just led to believe that the whole world's gone. And in 28 Days Later, there is sort of like an ending point to the story to some degree where you think there is the future. The future is like somewhat bright. The world's not over.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, that is super interesting, because this is, I mean, and one of our questions that we're going to get to is that this was a shot in the arm for the zombie genre. Like, what are other movies that did that for other genres? But specifically speaking about the zombie one, this is the film that did it. And then, like you said, since Walking Dead came out so close after, these two kind of walked hand in hand and paved that road.
Well, there has been so much zombie content now in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I found so interesting about watching this movie was like, how many of the scenes in this movie now feel like they've been done over and over again, the imagery, and how many of the scenes that I was watching and I was just like, I honestly had forgotten that this was probably where I first saw that image.
Yeah.
But it's been used over and over again.
I'm like building a crazy thesis in my mind.
Yeah.
Like I could win like a Nobel Prize thesis.
Okay, yeah.
It's that good. But it's basically talking, I mean, like what I'm thinking about is how, it's crazy how this, yeah.
It's about the film Tropic Thunder.
It's about the film Tropic Thunder.
Simple Jack and the misunderstood role by Ben Stiller as Simple Jack in the film Tropic Thunder.
Let me finish. God damn it, let me finish. No, it's about how the zombie genre is the only reason that it's lasted for so long. Like, think about Twilight. Think about vampires. Think about disaster movies and how those come and go. This has lasted for 17 years almost. It's been 15 years. I think it's because zombies, we don't ever deal with zombies. It's always about the people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
In vampire films, it's about dealing with vampires. In all those other movies, it's about dealing with the creature. Whereas zombie movies, in zombie films and TV shows, it's always boiled down to one thing.
Right.
It's about how humanity responds. Whereas all the other ones are about, we need to kill the vampire. We need to kill the werewolf. You know what I mean?
Yeah, completely. And also that zombies, because they're like this mindless mass, they have no sentience. You know, they have no personality. It's not like they're partly alive or partly awake. It's like they're... You just kill them and you move on. So it's like you're really just dealing with a threat. The threat could be the same thing. It could be hunger. It could be poverty. It could be anything. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, guys, those are going to be our initial thoughts opening up this episode here on 28 Days Later. If you want to follow along in the conversation, Andrew will be in the chat for about 7 more minutes. And
I'm getting a new phone.
And you can follow us each on Twitter. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media, Twitter or Instagram.
That was pretty funny. You proud of yourself for that? I thought that was very funny.
That?
Yeah, you guys can find me at Andrew Guy on Instagram and Twitter, and you can find our podcast at AMA Podcast on Twitter.
And lastly, guys, I have a brand new show that I've been doing for 2 weeks.
Yeah, and it's been doing really well.
Yeah, every single day I do it. It's called Fist Pump Film Club, and it's on Anchor, which is podcast meets Twitter. So it's like 2 to 3 minute audio blurbs that get put on a little like app radio station. If you call in, I can post your call directly to my channel if I want to, or initially I'm the only person that hears it. And the stories fall off after 24 hours. So it's just like 2 to 3 minutes at a time.
Coolest Snapchat ever for things that are more important than what did you eat for lunch today.
Yeah, it's like, and I only talk about movies, the best movies, what's going on in the movie world, and the best parts in those movies. It's really inspired by this show. So go download Anchor and follow Fist Pump Film Club. I also have a Magic the Gathering station, but you know, it's less relevant to this show.
And it's so new that you guys can literally talk to Ben one-on-one. He will put you on air. He'll bring your calls on. So if you want to be featured, you want to do it, now's the time.
Yeah, you just call in. I post calls. I get a bunch of call-ins. It's really awesome. It's like super, super fun. Yeah. Next Tuesday, I'm debuting Top 50 Tuesday, where I'm going to be counting down my top 50 movies for 50 weeks.
You're going to do it.
Yes. One movie a week.
50 weeks. That's cool. Okay, so when Ben and I got hammered and watched Anaconda, we started making our top 50. My niece watched that movie, or watched that episode.
Oh, really?
My favorite thing was that I always thought it was Christopher Walken in that role. I died when she said that. I don't know why. What was I saying about our Anaconda episode? Oh, when we were getting together to watch Anaconda, we decided to sit down and write. Ben's like, I know this seems ridiculous, and I know we've done it before, but let's just take 15 minutes and just brainstorm our free-form, tangential 50 favorite movies.
Yeah.
And it was really cool.
Yeah.
I actually got like 40-something down.
I got close to 100 in the end, and I've been trimming it down, just trying to give myself enough days so I don't forget anything really important.
Do you have your number one?
Well, my number one favorite movie of all time is Point Break.
And that's just going to be your number one, so people already know that.
Yeah, it's not really... For me, it's not so much about revealing which are my favorites. It's more about taking 3 to 4 minutes per movie per day on those days, on those Tuesdays, and just sort of having a mini AMA fist pump moment sort of feeling about each movie once a week.
Yeah, and also just being who you and I are, to actually know what your favorite movies are.
Yeah.
To be like, oh yeah, my top 5 favorite movies are this, 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 and this.
Yeah,
be
it's
like,
hard to do.
Really? And be like, no, trust me, I put hundreds of hours into this. Yeah.
I'm not quite there yet, but there's movies that I love that are like getting trimmed. You know, it's like I realized like City of God not going to make my top 50. I realized I don't think Children of Men is going to make my top 50. You know, Mad Max Fury Road not
going to
make my top
out.
50. Empire Strikes Back won't make my top 50. Like, these are movies that are on the list, but I just know I can't put them in the list. So
yeah.
Anyway, guys, we're going to watch the trailer right now for 28 Days Later, and then we are going to share our thesis statement. Marissa Serafini up in the booth. What's going on, Marissa?
What's up, Marissa?
Hello, gentlemen. Happy birthday, Andrew.
Thank you, Marissa. Richard Jarvie here says, cool show on Anchor, Ben, and thanks for airing my call.
Of course, man. Yeah. Thanks for calling in.
We're drinking scotch, by the way.
In case you were wondering. Ooh, it's a bad trailer already.
Yeah, you can tell it's bad. I like want to change the channel.
Show the full frontal in the trailer?
Is this a UK trailer?
Maybe they blacked it out. Did we just show the full frontal on the show?
Spoiler alert.
No! No! And that was the day Andrew and Ben were fired.
So who are you?
Wake up today in hospital. Wake up and I'm hallucinating.
Fucking hallucinating.
there.
Infected.
Infected.
Father.
Infected with what?
I shouldn't have done that.
The blood. There's something in the blood.
Mom, you can always put one of those things up if you want to listen to it.
You never go anywhere alone unless you've got no choice.
Hello?
It's made like one of those really shitty straight-to-DVD trailers.
Yeah. Well, you remember this era.
See, this is a really shit idea. You know why?
It's also
obviously a shit idea.
We have to leave now. More will be coming. I always do.
He, like, wasn't really anybody yet.
No. He'd done the
beach. You hear
that song? Yeah.
You know what that is?
It's from Sunshine, isn't it?
It's called To Heal by the band Underworld, and it plays at the end of Sunshine.
The dead.
Yeah. I've and listened to it on next. Repeat for an hour or an hour before. It's a 2.5-minute song.
Who uses music better in films?
Than Danny Boyle?
Yeah. Paul Thomas?
Maybe. I think Scorsese has a strong argument. He's used music really well, I think.
Did we just talk over, and did you just finish the trailer early, Marissa? It's okay if you did. I'm not...
End.
That was the end? Okay, I was just going to say, did we just, like, quit caring so much because that trailer was so bad?
Really bad trailer. Dark, grainy, definitely a lot of the worst elements of this movie were shown in that trailer just now. Like, the parts of this movie that make it sort of the, like, low-budge, pulpy sort of horror movie, which is probably the worst part of it.
Yeah, there's something about it that used to be kind of cool. It was kind of, like, grainy and gritty and raw and real, and now that we've kind of moved forward so far in cinema and cinematography, we realized they were just using tricks.
Well, it was DV. I mean, it's the same. It's 02 released in 03, collateral shot in 04, 03, 04. It's that grainy digital video thing where people hadn't quite... Now it's just common, but at the time, the switch, digital video looked a lot grainier.
Yeah, and then like with the way that they filmed all the night scenes during the daytime, and then the way that they did the stuff with the zombies, and they would film on a camera that would film at like 1600 FPS and all that. So it's weird because those things, they're used intentionally, but they have aged poorly.
There's also like some really interesting tricks in this movie. It's a very fascinating movie because I think Danny Boyle... Well, this is going to be great. We should get into our next part of our show here. So let's get into Thesis Statement, guys. This is Thesis Statement. It's your first time watching, first time listening. This is the part in the show where we share like a big, bold thought, something, the strongest thought we have about the movie, the greatest this, the best this, the first this, something not like, this is my favorite performance by Cillian Murphy in the 2000s, or like, this is one of the 10 best zombie movies I saw as a teenager.
Right.
It should be like, this is the best zombie movie ever, or, you know, something like that. And we share those thoughts, and we kind of just, like, ride those thoughts throughout the entire episode. So I'll jump in with mine because it's...
We did show the penis.
Did we?
I think so. I think that was the Red Band trailer. People are like, well, that was the first penis on AMA.
Is that a real thing?
Apparently. Let's see. Oh, Day of the Triffids. Triffids is
confirms the penis.
Confirms the penis, actually. It's the same shot-for-shot penis. Anyway. Please continue.
So, in any case, where was I? I lost my train of penis. No.
Talk about the thesis.
So, thesis statement.
Mom, you having fun?
So, this is what happens when you drink on the air. No. What I was going to say is, with the thesis statement, so, I was watching this movie and I was noticing all of these, like, small, weird details that Danny Boyle threw in. Like, for instance, you know that scene when they're sleeping in the parents' house? In his parents' house? Do you notice, like, the top left, there's, like, you see Jim's face? I never noticed it before, but it's like they're showing the city and the sunrise, basically, and you just see like kind of a faded, just like oval of his face sleeping.
Really?
Yeah, it's like it's a weird thing. I was like, that's a strange shot. It's like they're in the middle of a fade and they just stay on it.
No. I do know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
And it's cool. It wasn't like bad. It just was one of those things where I was like, that's so weird. And then there's also that scene when they're driving and there's that shot of the car from a distance.
Yeah.
And it looks like a Van Gogh painting.
Mm-hmm.
And the flowers are all painted.
Yeah.
So weird. Like, those are like those things where they're really cool, but like they're... This was this part of his career where he hadn't really become Danny Boyle yet.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's... We've come... I think it's so funny because Tony Scott and Danny Boyle are literally worlds apart. But it's true that these directors really come into their own. And even if they step away for, like, a film or something, like, I mean, Slumdog is reminiscent of Danny Boyle, but it's not quite. I mean, like, Sunshine and 28 Days Later feel so much like him, his style. But it's just interesting as these directors kind of develop and mature and they really, really have, like, this is my style now.
Yeah,
you
right.
know? Yeah.
They feel cleaner, slicker, less gimmicky, yeah. like less choppy. I think the thing about this movie, I mean, so my thesis statement is this. This is the most important movie of Danny Boyle's career. Through and through, and no question in my mind. And it's a hard one to defend because the obvious movie you would throw in there would be Slumdog because he won the Oscar yeah. for Best Picture.
And right? director.
Did he win Best Director? Yeah. So you throw in Slumdog, right? That's a huge one. That's a big win. He gets Best Picture nominations for both 127 Hours and Steve Jobs. Trainspotting is a cult classic from its era, right? Sunshine is a movie that, like, pretty much every person who likes good movies absolutely yeah. adores.
Absolutely.
Shallow Grave, to a lot of people, is a classic.
Still haven't seen that.
I mean, like, Danny Boyle is this guy who's made all these movies people love. But I would say there is no movie in his career more important than 28 Days Later. And the reason I say it is this. You can look at every other movie he's ever made that was well-received, right? Every other one, maybe that was a better movie, better, cleaner movie, more professional, more important story. Even if you look at Slumdog, which is a phenomenal movie and one yeah. of my 50 favorite movies, for sure. Mm-hmm. More so than this.
Yeah.
But this is the most important zombie movie of our lifetime.
Definitely.
It's probably the most important horror movie of our lifetime. And it literally redefined the entire genre. It's the first time we saw fast zombies. And Danny Boyle made this on a shoestring budget early in his career. Like, if you take every single horror movie that's come out since we were kids and you trace them all back to this movie, like, this is kind of like the referendum point for movies. Like, it's just, it's terrifying
yeah.
and scary and interesting and dark and dramatic. It's not cheesy.
And innovative.
It's not using cheap scares to scare you. It's legitimately scary.
Yeah, there's none of those, like, dah, really quick, dah, you know, like. And or you turn around and it's your friend.
Yeah.
It's none of that crap.
And it's such a simple, small movie. That's the thing I was noticing while I was watching it. You know, my fist pump moment, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but my fist pump moment just specifically references, like, one of the things that makes this movie so special.
We didn't talk about it, did we?
No.
I'm so curious.
So that's yeah. my thesis statement. This is the most important movie Danny Boyle ever made. And it's a weird one to defend, but I think in an argument with anybody, I could win that argument. I think strongly about it.
Yeah, I think that the only person that you would have a really hard time debating against would be someone that argued Trainspotting and had done all their homework. You know what I mean? Something like that.
Yeah, because it's one of the absolute cult iconic indie movies.
Sure.
Of the
and
90s.
They're doing, you know, a sequel 20 years later yeah. and they're doing all that. And it's like he wouldn't have ever had the opportunity to make Slumdog if he hadn't have done Trainspotting. I don't disagree with you. I just don't know if I do agree.
Sure.
You know, I feel like I need to do a little homework. But I really do like that. And this is my favorite Danny Boyle movie, so probably. My thesis is pretty straightforward, and I think I had to claim it because it just needed to be said. This is the best zombie movie ever made. I really agree with that. I really feel very strongly about that. And I've watched all the old ones. I've watched, you know, Dawn of the Dead. I've watched the ones that are back in black and white. And then, like, they're all so important to the genre. But what was so great about this movie was that, first of all, it's not the same. The zombies are different. They're not dying, coming back to life. It's like being infected with rage, which I thought was so interesting, and, like, what was going on with our culture and Ebola and blah, blah, blah. But what I loved about it is that it really made you realize, and it's like what we talked about earlier, is that the thing about zombies is that they're really just a placeholder. They're a MacGuffin for dealing with society and people.
Yeah,
and
right.
Like you said, anything. So the reason that I think this is the most important zombie movie is because it reminded us that, like, we could have an awesome horror movie with a monster or a creature in it that really just brought out the terrors of human and mankind.
Well, that's why rage is what it is.
Yeah, it's
inspired by road rage
yeah.
and political anger and all of these, you know, and like anger at poverty and like all these feelings and emotions that people in actual culture were feeling. And they were like, let's make the zombie outbreak not about wanting to eat brains, but let's
yeah.
make it about being angry.
Like exactly. And like even now it hits home. Like how angry are so many of us
yeah.
every day? We wake up and we look at our phones, we look at the news, we look at Twitter, and we're just like, fuck.
Just look at Roka's Twitter feed.
Yeah, right? Just look at John Roka's Twitter feed and you'll just be mad. But that's what I think was so cool. And I think that's why this is the most important zombie movie ever. And also just like, it's the same thing like when you're watching a movie. Don't go back there. Don't go around the door. Don't turn that light on. Like, just walk away from it. It's a zombie.
Right.
It's just walking.
Yeah.
You could literally just shut the door and you're safe.
Yeah, there's also like one of like two really interesting aspects. Watching it this time, I had totally forgotten. They don't bite you.
No.
They're not. They're like, they're just like hitting you and like throwing you.
Hitting
and
you and like spitting blood on you. And then they eat you eventually if like
yeah.
that, if it comes to it. But it's like, that's not their thing. It's not like brains.
They're not going for your neck or your face or your arm. It's not really like that. And it was such like so interesting to watch. They're like terrifying. You know, we hired athletes to play zombies.
Yeah.
Right?
And and I couldn't find it this time around, and please correct me if I'm wrong, people out there, even if you know, but I'm pretty sure the priest was the first one.
You mentioned that before. I don't know that, but...
So what I had heard, and one of my friends told me, because one of my best friends in college, my roommate, he and I love this movie, and he was saying when he'd read somewhere is that the very first zombie you encounter intimately is the priest in the church, and they were saying that Danny Boyle kind of just had him do his thing, and he did that like erratic, like spastic movement thing in the sound, and he was like, that's what we're going to do for everybody. I don't know if that's true or not. That's what I'd heard loosely, but like, yeah. They're terrifying, and like so many people, you see them get infected by just getting like the blood spit on them. It's not about getting bit, which is like, I think, scarier almost.
For sure. And that's gonna lead us directly into our next segment, guys, which is called Fist Pump Moment. Fist Pump Moment's that moment when you're watching a movie, something happens, and you're just like, this is so awesome. I get to watch the rest of this movie.
Nope.
Are you seeing this? Are you seeing this? This is so good! You want to call your buddy and be like, hey, turn the movie on. Go to 12 minutes. I know.
Your jury duty? I don't care.
I don't care. Walk out. Drain your data plan. I need you to watch this on YouTube right now. And that's the Fist Pump Moment. It can be anything. It can be the sound. It can be a music track, a touching look between father and son, that look that Nick Nolte gives to Joel Edgerton in the last 7 minutes.
Straight across.
Warrior. Yep. Yeah, that's beautiful. An insert shot.
They flew Nick Nolte back out just to pick up that shot.
That's a fist pump moment right there.
Yeah.
Can be anything. Fist pump, we've been talking about him for, 95 episodes. So my fist pump moment, and I love this one, and I always remember this one. Brendan Gleeson, I think, is the best part of this movie. I think he's the best. I just think he's the best part of the movie. I think
Do we have the same fist pump?
It might be. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
Going. Yeah.
And it's, he's so angry when they find out that when they get to this this little encampment they were supposed to report to, that this they're not going to be saved, and there's no army and there's no cure.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been trying ever since you first met him to like spin it positive and remain positive and be there for his daughter and encourage her. And he's such a loving father, and he loves her so much. Mm-hmm. And when he finds out that he's just angry, and he's like, well, where the fuck are we going to go? And he's so mad.
Yeah.
And he walks away for a second, and he sees this crow eating the zombie, and he's like, get out of it. You're going to turn into the thing. Like,
get off of it. Yeah.
He's still like a good heart. He's like, I want this bird not to turn. And the drop of blood drops in his eye. And then his daughter starts to walk up to him, and he knows, I've always remembered this moment. He knows that he maybe has 20 seconds. He has 20 seconds, and he's going to get to tell her consciously that he loves her maybe one more time.
Yeah.
And he just pauses, and he's just like, I just want you to know that I love you very much. I'm sorry. Yep. I'm sorry I yelled at you. I'm sorry I lost my temper.
Love
and she's like,
much.
What? I love you very much. And she's like, get away from me. Get away from me. And he kind of throws her.
Yeah.
And it's just the best moment in the whole movie, because he's the best character, and he's the thing that grounds the movie, and his love for his daughter is really what keeps the movie together. It's so bleak when you first meet Naomi Harris. Before you meet Brendan Gleeson, it's like, it's kind of like watching District 9. It's like, this movie's great, but it's just so gritty. Like, am I ever going to want to watch this again? There's no character that I really love here. It's everybody's just kind of this. She's like so pragmatic, and you meet Brendan Gleeson, and he's just this symbol of hope, and you're like, that's what it would be like to have a daughter in this situation.
Where's my dad?
Yeah.
Where's my dad?
Even when he's like, it's a celebration, and she's like, it's, mom stuff. And he's like, you're right, your mother's, and it's just everything about him just, and it breaks my heart.
He's the best part of the film.
Yeah, he's my
absolutely
favorite.
Is.
He's my favorite.
And
part.
That's why you and I are best friends. That's my fist pump.
Exactly.
We did not talk about, absolutely. It's Jacob Leafs as well.
Yeah.
It's, there's something so, just, it's such a tragic moment when that drop falls in his eyes and he has that moment. And like, for to speak to him as an actor, you feel like, oh my God, his daughter, he can't be there for her anymore. And it's like the thought process of that moment. Like, my mom's sitting here on the couch. It's like, imagine that you're sitting there protecting your child in this hell, literally in hell.
Like at the end of the road.
Literally the end of the road.
Yeah.
And something happens. And you realized, and like the amount of thought that happens in that moment, in Brendan Gleeson, isn't, it's like, I'm going to die. I can't help my daughter. She's going to die. How are we going to get out of here? What happened? I'm going to change and tell her I love her. Like, all this happens in 1 second. It's just brilliant and it's beautiful. And that's, I mean, that's probably my favorite line as well. But just for the show's purpose, I'll make it something else.
Yeah.
But for sure. It's when he goes, I love you. I love you very much.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for, you know, and you're just like...
He apologizes for yelling. Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's such a good scene. And when you talk about the things I didn't remember about this movie, mm-hmm. that's one I absolutely did. That's the scene I think that I always have remembered about this movie more than any other. It's probably Jim waking up and yeah. walking around the empty city, and then this. So that's just a great moment. That actually brings us into our next segment, guys. It's a brand new segment we're debuting on the show today for the very first time.
Yes.
And this is innovative. It's brand new stuff. If you're in the chat, if you're a longtime listener, longtime watcher, you're going to know right where we're going with this, because it's so what we are into.
Yes.
But this is a segment called Just Add Cox.
And it's not dirty, even though it sounds dirty.
So you guys may know... You may know that we love Tom Cruise, we love Denzel Washington, but when it comes to actors that are in the movies we love that are not the lead character,
they are not top three billed usually.
Yeah, Brian Cox is like top of the list. He's yeah. like, we've probably referenced Brian Cox more than almost anyone.
And one of the reasons why we talk about Brian Cox is you look at all the movies he's been in, whether he's hilarious or not, but it's like Troy is an example of him just owning it, being awesome. But, like, there's these people, and Troy and Braveheart are both perfect examples of, like, great epics because they have Brendan Gleeson and Brian Cox in both of them. And essentially what we're doing here is that there's these guys that get put in movies that aren't billed at the top, but if they're in the movie, it will be better no matter what. Just because their name is on the list, it will be a better film.
So, like, when you get a movie made, usually with a big budget, you've got to have a star attached. And then you need to have, like, a couple other people, either some
up-and-comers. We will use Safe House as an example because it's a perfect example.
Yeah, to get the movie made, you need Denzel. Yep. Without Denzel, the movie doesn't get made, right?
But you also need a young, hot up-and-comer, so you pick up Ryan Reynolds. Cool.
You put Ryan Reynolds in there. So then you think, okay, now we have all these other roles, and these are going to be the character roles, right? Mm-hmm. These aren't going to be leads, but they're going to be good roles. So you start thinking, you go down the list, there's not that many actors who have big enough cachet where you know they're going to do a good job. You don't need to audition them. You can just offer them the part because you've worked with them before, you've seen them and stuff.
They're not going to try to steal the scene. They're just going to fill a role perfectly.
So Brendan Gleeson gets the role in that film because Brendan Gleeson's fantastic.
Yes.
Our favorite person who does this of all time is Brian Cox. Let's just run through his, like, 95 to 04 filmography for a second. You've got Braveheart. You've got Troy. You've got Adaptation.
Yep.
You've got X-Men 2.
Yep.
You've got Bourne Identity. You've got Bourne Supremacy. You've got The Ring. Did I say Adaptation?
I'm so glad that you're doing it this way because, you know, I don't even need to pull up my phone. You could just repeat those 6 or 7, 8 to 10 movies over and over and over. So you're looking at all those movies and you're like, okay, and where is he on the billing list? He's like fifth.
Isn't he the dad in Garden State? I'm pretty sure he's the father in Garden State. I'm almost positive he's Zach Braff's dad. So,
I think
the therapist.
Could be right. Hey, Marissa, do you know that off the top of your head or no?
I can look it up. I'm almost positive Brian Cox plays Zach Braff's dad in Garden State. And he's just great in all those roles. We love Brian Cox.
Yeah.
And he's been my fist pump moment in multiple movies. His first scene in Bourne Supremacy.
Yeah.
When Pam Landy, what do you know about Jason Bourne?
Never heard of him.
It just clearly does, but he's just like, he's just disgruntled.
He's like,
yeah, just brr.
Yeah, people love Brian Cox.
Yeah.
They're talking about their fist pumps and all that. You know, this is still kind of a loose idea, but we're trying to like tie it together.
The premise behind Just Add Cox is that every movie is made better with Brian Cox.
Mm-hmm.
Every movie, right? That's our feeling, is that every single movie is made better with Brian Cox.
Yes.
But he's not the only one. There's a list of guys and girls, so when you put them in a movie,
sure.
are just phenomenal, like just really, really do it. And so we started to come up
Vera with... Vera Farmiga is also, she could be one for the females.
She's quite
like
good,
you look at her in Departed, you look at her in Safe House, she's always great.
She's great and Up in the Air.
Yep.
He's not in Garden State? He's not the dad?
No, Garden State.
I wonder who the dad is in Garden State. Anyway, so...
Oh, I know who it is. It just popped in my head, but
really?
I can't think of his name.
So the premise here is that just like in sports, just like in baseball when you have war, just like in basketball when you have PER, there's these metrics that sports use, sabermetrics, which is like a certain number of points that you get for having a player on the roster. It's like number of wins above replacement, right?
Yes, yes.
And so in movies, we started to think about, you add Tom Cruise or Denzel to a movie, of course the movie's going to be awesome. But that's going to spend Ian Holm. Yeah.
Ian Holm, yep.
That's going to spend the majority of... What'd you say?
I was going to say that's going to cost millions.
Yeah, it's going to cost millions. I mean, it costs a huge amount of money, and you can't put multiples of those in unless it's like a Fast and the Furious movie. So you start thinking about the list, you know, when you add somebody like a Brian Cox, when you essentially just add Cox, who are you getting your highest return on investment in the form of quality of the movie?
And so it's like Bill Paxton was one of our, like Bill Paxton was a great one.
Paxton's RAR is extremely high.
It's extremely high.
So we're calling this RAR, which is rating above replacement and rating in terms of either IMDb score or Rotten Tomatoes score. We haven't quite decided. I think it's probably IMDb score because Tomatoes can't reference old movies very well.
Yeah, they really don't. They don't. the rating does not age well.
Yeah, so I think we're going to go with the IMDb rating. But RAR is the new statistic, and Brian Cox is the guy that inspired this. But in this film, Brendan Gleeson's RAR is phenomenal. Like, I think I think Brendan Gleeson's RAR in this movie is at least 0.5. Like, it maybe it's probably not a full point, but like it's pretty friggin'
high. We're talking like batting average. If we're thinking like one is perfect,
like I think probably
1.0 is perfect.
No, like number of points he's worth. That's like on a score.
Well, no, but you're talking about like an ERA like 0.987 or point.
Like this movie probably got like a 7.7 or 8 something or something like that. Something like that.
Uh-huh.
So I'm saying of the 7.6 that this movie got on IMDb, I think he's worth probably 0.6 of it. I think if you put...
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Let's just say you put an Ian Holm, who's a very good actor.
Ian Holm, Ray Winstone, Departed. Yeah. Like,
those guys are great. Those guys are all probably pretty close to Gleason.
Oh, they're in there, yeah. Yeah.
But sure. I mean, there's guys like, I'll bet you if you put Chris Cooper in the role, it's like he probably has a RAR of like 0.8.
Oh, I bet his is super high.
Yeah.
Gary Sinise in the 90s, probably like 0.6.
Very high RAR.
Very high. So I think you guys basically get the idea here. It's essentially that there's these character actors that... It's a shot in the arm for the film.
Yeah.
You know, and like these people, Brendan Gleeson, Brian Cox, Ray Winstone, these are at the top of the list. Paxton.
Yeah.
So every time that we talk about this on the show, every time we bring in another one of these.
Goldberg in the early 90s.
That's right. See, his daughter was the biggest surprise, though. At least my favorite performance of his. Yeah. People are a fan. People love Brian Cox. So I think we're onto something here.
Yeah, Brian Cox. Just Ed Cox. So that's that. Just Ed Cox is a segment you guys are going to hear from us more often. So moving on from just adding Cox,
yes.
Brendan Gleeson just being the man in this movie, let's get into star profiles. You keep saying Cillian Murphy. And
it's Cillian.
Well,
Cillian? Cillian?
Are you sure?
I don't know.
Nor do I.
I think it's Cillian.
I used to say Cillian. Then I said Cillian for a long time.
Cillian. Are you sure? Have you heard him say it?
1,000%?
Have you heard him say it?
Cillian. Right. The spelling would suggest Cillian.
That was one thing about my buddy in college, and his name's Brian. I talk about him a lot.
Yeah.
He loved to pronounce, like, all these people's names when I say them.
Yeah.
You're like, why did you say Shadell? It's Cheadle.
Yeah.
Brian is the guy that put this, like, extra flair on all these words. Cillian, Shadell. Like, there's all, and then when I say them, I'm like, obviously that's wrong.
Yeah.
But I've been saying it this way for so long, I just like the way it sounds. Like, it should be Don Shadell.
Yeah. Wow, look at these three movies.
It's his fault.
Cillian
Murphy. Yeah, so you look at Cillian Murphy.
Go ahead. Yeah.
And he's got Disco Pigs in 2001.
Never heard of it.
On the Edge.
Never heard of it.
Never heard of him. On the Edge in 2001. And How Harry Became a Tree in 2001. Never heard of any of those films.
Nor have I.
And I actually didn't look them up for that purpose.
So, Cillian Murphy. Let's just do a quick over-under proper on him. I think that's probably
the easiest. Someone just said it's Cillian with a K. We'll never know.
It's not Cillian.
Well, I know they're saying pronunciation-wise. Okay, I didn't mean to cut you
off. It's one or the other.
Yes.
Let's do an over-under proper on Cillian Murphy. I think it's probably the easiest way to talk about his career because he had a big run after this movie. He's
with
had
the
some
Dark Knights and
really big stuff. I mean, Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, obviously Peaky
Rises,
Blinders was really
Peaky
big.
Blinders.
Sunshine was really big.
Did you watch Peaky Blinders, Mom? No, you watched Downton Abbey, right? Yeah, okay.
People loved it. Downton Abbey. Peaky Blinders is a very popular show. He's just been The Wind That Shakes the Barley is a movie that he was in I saw once. The Greatest Game Ever Played, or maybe that's Shia LaBeouf. But he's just in a bunch of stuff. He's one of those actors, when you see him in a movie, it's usually sort of like, oh, wasn't he the villain in Red Eye?
Yes.
Yeah. And not Flight Plan.
Not Flight Plan.
Which I got correctly.
Yes, you did get it. Guys, we're going back on the Schmodown real
very
soon.
Yeah, very soon. Yeah. Our episode premieres sometime soon. I'm not really sure when.
I think
when.
It's next week, maybe sometime, but not positive.
Yeah.
Us Against the Nerds Watch.
We'll have the date sooner than later. So Cillian Murphy, you know, it's this is what I'm going to say, my answer. Cillian Murphy is the poor man's Eddie Redmayne.
Which is so funny because I feel like Eddie Redmayne is the poor man's Eddie Redmayne.
Well, I know that you feel he's gotten too much hype. Like that.
I know. I don't know why, because
it's
he's
happened
incredibly
very fast.
Talented.
It's because it happened really fast.
But he's put in so much time on Broadway. I think what I need to do is sit down and read Eddie Redmayne's Wikipedia and then, like, watch one clip on him talking about acting. And I'll be like, oh, my God, his journey has been so brutal.
He's a really good actor. Yeah. But here's the difference between Eddie Redmayne and Cillian Murphy. Cillian Murphy essentially was in the position to be Eddie Redmayne 10 years ago.
But does Eddie Redmayne have movie star charisma? I don't think he does. I just think he's an incredible actor. Like, I don't even think Daniel Day-Lewis has movie star charisma.
Yeah, but I don't think that Eddie Redmayne is. So, like, here's what I would say. The reason I say this, that he's the poor man's Eddie Redmayne. Mm-hmm. You're never going to see either Eddie Redmayne or Cillian Murphy put on a bunch of muscle and play the starring role in some, like, big action adventure thing. Neither. And I'm not even talking playing, like, Robin Hood or, like, King Arthur. I'm definitely not playing John McClane in, the Die Hard reboot.
Right.
The best thing they're going to get is Fantastic Beasts and How to Find Them. That's the kind of starring franchise role these kind of actors would get, right? They basically are Burberry models who can win Oscars. That's like what they look like. Fair skinned, skinny, incredibly talented. They're like pretty and delicate looking almost.
Yeah, and they it's weird because Cillian has that look to him where he could almost be, he almost has a Chris Cooper effect where you're like, that guy's only a bad guy.
Yeah, right.
But he has just enough to where he can be a good guy. Wait, you didn't ever say how you actually feel, though.
I think in the end, the way I feel about him is that he is properly rated. And the reason I would say underrated, except that he's been put in position time and time again to sort of next
to succeed.
Level.
Yeah.
Just to like next level, to like to get that movie, to get that Oscar nomination, or to have that iconic role. And it's like he's worked a lot ever since he broke on with this movie. And he's had 15 years to really like break out with one of those roles.
Jesus, time flies.
You put Redmayne in like that same kind of position. He gets an Oscar nom and win, follows it up with another Oscar nom, and parlays that into Fantastic Beasts. And that's just in a few years.
Do you think that in 10 years, people still care about Eddie Redmayne?
Maybe. I think it's just as much as they care about Cillian Murphy.
That's fair.
Yeah, and he'll have the whole franchise of Fantastic Beasts. It's just something about... I went to a taping of Ellen fairly recently, and Eddie Redmayne was one of the guests. And so I sat like 20, 30 feet away from him for like a 10-minute interview.
How'd you feel about him?
He was great. Tons of charisma.
Yeah.
Tons, like, super high energy.
Movie star.
Yeah, he got asked to do, like, animal impressions, and he did, like, 10 in a row, and they were really good.
So crazy. You realize that all these people, like, no matter what level they're at, they're all stars.
He's a star.
He's a star.
And so, like, that's what I say. Like, I love Cillian Murphy. I think the guy's fantastic. Yeah. But I think he's properly rated because this is my feeling. If you see a billing with Cillian Murphy on it right now, he adds RAR. He's got a high RAR in your mind. He's high enough.
Yeah.
You see it, and you think, oh, yeah, he's good. He's going to add something to this movie that I want to see. He's not an irrelevant person.
Right.
You know, you think about people who have like a, like, there's actors out there who have like essentially an irrelevant RAR, right? Like, you talk about like, I don't know, Jai Courtney, for instance.
Oh, that's a guy. A great example of someone with no RAR.
He's just like,
I'm going to pay millions of dollars for you to do something that anyone can do.
Yeah, like, I'm just like, I'm not going to not like you in this movie, but you don't like really inspire me to want to see it. Amanda Peet. I'm like, all right, Amanda Peet's in a movie. She's very pretty. She's been quite good in several things, but I don't really go to see movies to see Amanda Peet.
No.
I think Cillian Murphy, his RAR is still pretty high, like at least 0.3, 0.4.
Yeah, I mean, he adds great value to Scarecrow.
Yeah.
Scarecrow's like the fifth build.
And he's not going to, and most movies, if he's in a big budget movie, he's probably getting the fourth, fifth, sixth billing. Yeah, he's not getting a starring role right now.
So it sounds like people think that it's Cillian, but we'll just keep moving on with that. And they were saying that, yeah, Redmayne has no flair, and I feel that way, but I think most people feel that way, but not a lot of people have seen him in person
or in
a talk show, and that makes sense. I agree with you, though.
Yeah.
Even though my reasons are completely different, I do think that he's properly rated, and he's definitely not underrated because he's the lead in two of my favorite films.
And he still gets a lot of work.
And he's also in all three of the Dark Knight films. You can't be the lead in two Danny Boyle films and in three Christopher Nolan films and not be rated well.
Exactly.
You know, like, that's those opportunities. You're working with two of the greatest directors ever.
Yeah.
And especially of our generation. So I do think he's properly rated, and I can just put it down to one thing, is he doesn't have movie star charisma. He doesn't have that thing that you and I always talk about that the Goslings have and that the Cruises have and that all the old movie stars have. He just doesn't have it.
Yeah.
He might have it in person, but he doesn't have it on screen where you're just like, I just want to watch you talk about anything.
Yeah.
He just doesn't have that. And he also, I don't think that you can be a leading man, actor, superstar, and have that look of being like, are you a bad guy?
Yeah.
You can't have that.
I mean, I think he peaked already. I think I think no pun intended with the Peaky Blinders there, but I think he definitely peaked already, and I think that he's still a solid working actor. The likelihood of him getting one of those roles, those career defining, big time like Oscar nominated roles, seems pretty low to me at this point.
Yeah,
but you never know. People age into different parts of their career, so
he could always come back. So let's move on to to Naomi Harris, who was like nobody,
pretty much. Yeah.
She was absolutely nobody. It was hard to find.
She had sweet hair though.
She did. What I liked is that. Okay, so first of all, it was she did If Looks Could Kill, The Power of Behavior, which is a short film in 2000, and then she did Living in Hope in 2002 and Anansi in 2002 as well. This was her movie. This is the one that put Naomi Harris on the map. This is the one that kind of had people pay attention to her, which is funny because she didn't really get a lot of notable work for a while. And it was only until recently that I really kind of fell in love with her, because I think she is a very, very good actress.
Big year this year with Moonlight.
Moonlight, yeah, with Moonlight and with the Will Smith movie.
Collateral Beauty?
Yeah, she's in that as well. She's his. Yeah, there's a twist in there.
Did you watch it?
I won't give it away. I actually did. I saw it with my mom and my sisters at Christmas. I don't think I would have liked it if I wasn't like with family over Christmas, but it was actually good in that sense. Yeah, she just knew. She's great. I think that this is just one of those things. It's like, this was her opportunity. This was her one film to really push herself into the next level. And she does great. And her and Danny Boyle developed a backstory that she had to kill her mother and father to save her little brother.
Who turns out was already infected.
Yeah, so she ended up having to murder her whole family for no reason.
Yeah.
Other than the infection, which is why that moment when she turns and kills her friend.
Yeah.
Instantly, it's so brutal, but it makes that. And I wish they were able to kind of inject that in or put that in the film somehow, so that you could really understand why she's able to just turn on someone that's been her companion so quickly. Yeah,
yeah, that's actually another thing. Talking about how many of the scenes in this movie feel familiar, like I've seen them before.
Mm-hmm.
That scene when he's telling the story about the handful of cash at the station and the soft people. That's like probably would be in my top three fist pump moments. Monologue. It's a really good monologue, and it's. That scene has been done now in a lot of these zombie stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
That same scene, that same story, and that same imagery they create of, like, the world and money being irrelevant and just being willing to kill everyone to get your family out and trying to save your family and just, like, losing your family. They're just gone.
Yeah, I mean, those shots of the bus tipped over and the hospital and the money on the steps and all the posters on the wall.
Yeah.
Those are all pulled from real-life things. September 11th and the posters on the wall of missing people, that was actually an unintentional connection.
Yeah.
That they had filmed the missing people on the wall prior to the attacks, and the attacks happened, and that was posted, and it was, like, very uncomfortable. Danny Boyle was like, we would have never put that in the film had this been filmed afterwards. And the other thing with the money, that it was a place called, like, Pot Pan or Pot somewhere, like a foreign, I can't remember exactly, you know, you read the same stat, where it was, like, there were pictures of that where it was just, like, money everywhere after a government had collapsed, essentially. And it's just like, this is useless.
Something
very haunting about that.
So, guys, we are running long right now, so we're going to sort of just try to move through some of this other stuff. Though there's a few very important pieces here. Alex Garland, this is pretty relevant. We've talked about him a lot. So Alex Garland wrote the novel The Beach. That's he broke out with writing the novel The Beach. And in the 90s, The Beach sold like 700,000 copies, was translated in 25 languages. It was a very, like, Generation X, incredibly important film. Our buddy Jason, for instance, probably remembers The Beach. And he's exactly the age where he would have read The Beach and been like, oh, yeah, that movie's sweet. And the movie is good. That's a good movie with DiCaprio, but it does fall apart at the end because it becomes this sort of, like, slasher adventure thing. And Garland didn't actually write the script for that. He wrote the book.
Okay.
But then he writes this, 28 Days Later, which is a hit. And I think that the end of this movie is tonally kind of wrong.
Still, you feel like it's the
best of the three, but still a little wrong. And then Sunshine as well, which is another one of my favorites. And again, the ending of that movie of the three also feels like pretty bad. Like, not
I do
correct.
Feel like the end of Sunshine gets a little crazy.
So around the same time in 2005, he was hired to write the script for Halo. He wrote a script for the movie Halo. The movie was supposed to go in production in 2006, was canceled in 2008, and then is now back on the block to get made. So,
and I never saw Ex Machina.
Nor did I, which
and,
is funny because
people talk about how that's like a sign of, like, the light at the end of the tunnel for him.
He's got your doppelganger.
I am Oscar Isaacs, okay? I could do him. I could do his roles. And I haven't seen that. And for you guys that have, that could be a really nice... I know, I said I could do him.
No, I was just thinking how funny a sketch would be of you being like, I do a great Oscar Isaacs impersonation.
And
then you look at it.
And I'm just myself.
And it's just nothing like
him.
No, I look just like
him. He's impersonating me, okay? I think that he... I think that with the way that movie was received, it might be like a step in the right direction for him, because I do agree. The Beach is ridiculous. Sunshine feels very ridiculous. This film, I think I have like a bias towards enjoying it.
It's the best of the three.
But it still does just a little bit. You're like, when did you become a superhero?
Yeah.
When did that happen where you like were just like, all right, I'm going to kill everybody.
Yeah, right. All of a sudden, I like am not going to fall down. I can like just kill everyone, get away, like set the zombie loose, not worry that it's going to kill the girls. Like, just like so much stuff where at the end
it's like all of a sudden you've become the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah, and then Lily drives the she like drives Hannah drives the car backwards, and she's like, I'm gonna time it, even though I'm like Vicodined up, I'm gonna like time it so that it like drives
the guy
this thing,
grabs him.
Yeah,
and
that whole ending is just, what is this? This is so different than what I just watched.
It feels like a trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's Alex Garland. So moving on to Danny Boyle.
I mean, Danny Boyle, you know, it's hard to talk about Danny Boyle a lot now. It's again, he's become one of those directors that's so, he transcends that of a director. He's become so famous in our generation of directors. And so he was brought up in a working class Catholic family, and he was an altar boy for 8 years, and his mother really wanted him to join the priesthood. And it was at age 14 that a priest told him not to do it. And Danny Boyle says specifically, he says, whether he was saving me from the priesthood or the priesthood from me, which I think is also interesting, I don't know. But quite soon after, I started doing drama, and there's a real connection, I think. All these directors, Scorsese, Wu, Shyamalan, they were all meant to be priests. There's something very theatrical about it. It's basically the same job, pouncing around and telling people what to think. And I think that's such a cool thing, because that is really what priests and religion tell you, like, tell you how to feel about stuff, how to think about things. And, like, I'm an actor, you know that. And it's like, literally, that's what directors do, is just tell you how to think. And I pulled that because I think that's the most interesting thing. If you guys want to know more about Boyle and his career and how he became in Slumdog in 127 Hours, go look at his Wikipedia. But he's one of both of our favorite directors.
No question.
Sure.
I've said this for a long time. On Anchor last week, I did a lot of Danny Boyle content with Trainspotting 2 coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Talked about my three favorite movies. I talked about that I believe he's the most underrated living director. I talked about if you look at Danny Boyle's career pre and post Slumdog, it's a very different story. Everything prior to Slumdog is like an upscale indie movie, and everything Slumdog and after, I would say save Trance and Trainspotting 2. And Trainspotting 2 is new, but Trance is the only weird one because no one saw that movie. But everything else, as far as like Steve Jobs, Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours, they're these like very high-profile indie character movies where
They're like really high-budget movies that are trying to be indies.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. I mean, and this is the other thing I always said. I would say he is the modern-day Peter Weir. So Peter Weir is like Australian, was like one of my favorites growing up. His most famous movie is probably The Truman Show.
Yeah.
But Master and Commander, a great example of that is like Peter Weir trying to do Master and Commander. That's him trying to do a big budget like adventure movie.
Yeah.
That's the closest to a big budget adventure movie he can get.
And that movie really did fall flat.
Yeah.
Some people like it.
It's just okay. But like the movies that he succeeds with are like Dead Poets Society, The Truman Show, Witness, The Mosquito Coast, The Year of Living Dangerously. These are like fearless. Like Peter Weir is a great, great example of a guy who did consistent work at a very high level for a long time and just was always like you mentioned Nolan with Cillian Murphy. I think it's so interesting because I said this over the weekend when I was in San Antonio, and I actually got to hang out with a couple of our fans.
Mm-hmm.
Diana and Ryan are a couple, a married couple that listen to the show, and I got to spend a lot of time with them because Ryan plays magic. I was on a team with him. It was very fun. And
super awesome.
It was
so
cool to get to talk to them. So big shout out to you guys if you're watching this right now or listening. But I made the comment that Diana said, how can a guy that won an Oscar be underrated? I don't understand what you mean. And I said, well, think about it. Compare Christopher Nolan to Danny Boyle. Do you feel like who's regarded as the better director? One's won an Oscar, the other hasn't, right?
Yeah.
Nolan's like regarded as like maybe the best director alive right now.
There's something about him where it's just like,
yeah, he's the guy. Like even David Fincher, I would say, is like sort of closer to Nolan.
Yeah,
Danny Boyle.
I feel like every single director, I mean, the ones that really are up there, like the Spielbergs and the Camerons.
Scorsese,
but those guys are still not at the same level as Nolan, which is so weird because he's doing a different type of new
film. Or at least
film.
They're in the same circle. Whereas it feels like Boyle is barely hanging on to the bottom rung.
But it's like, it feels like newer actors or producers. Like if I was to talk to like a 25-year-old, I'd be like, who would you want to act in or produce whose film? They'd be like, well, Nolan.
Yeah.
But what about Spielberg? It's like, I mean, he just did Bridges, but you know, yeah. So
I feel like Danny Boyle, like people would be, it'd be like Damien Chazelle, Danny Boyle. And it'd be like a similar conversation. And you're like, how many good movies does he have to do before Danny Boyle just gets to be like one of the three or four best living directors? He's unbelievable. The guy
has
made
incredible.
I mean, yeah, so anyway, that's how I feel about the guy, and I just think it's crazy. He's criminally underrated, just consistently.
Absolutely. So next we got Andrew McDonald, which is, I mean, it makes sense for this film because it was so low budget, but it's so rare that you get just one producer on a film. He was the co-founder of DNA Films alongside Duncan Kenworthy, and which is basically one of the most successful production companies in the UK with T2, Last King of Scotland, Sunshine, 28 Days Later. McDonald has worked with Boyle and Garland on Sunshine and 28 Days Later, and he produced Garland's directorial debut, Ex Machina, which was very successful. Yeah, I mean, he's just a very smart producer in charge of a very smart production company in the UK. If you guys look at DNA Films, you'll see that they don't really miss a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's pretty much that. Moving on to the budget. This movie was made for $8 million. That's crazy. This is probably the lowest budget movie we've ever done on here.
Absolutely. It's the lowest budget movie, and the only movie that feels even similar to stretch the budget is Looper.
Yeah, and that's 30.
Yeah.
40, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, $8 million.
It opened June 27th in 2003. It grossed $45 million domestically, an additional $37 million. For a grand total of $82 million, which is 10 times its budget.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the string of movies in the early 2000s that really greenlit the horror genre as the low-budget genre for new directors to get into. If you want to make a hit movie for like a very, very small amount of money, make a ton of money back and have the cred to make the thing you want, you make a horror movie.
Yeah.
That's what they started doing.
Yeah, and I'm gonna fly through these numbers real quick, and that's actually going to get us to a question from Jacob Leaf. So, worldwide, total gross, 82. Opening weekend, it was number 4, but behind Charlie's Angels 2, Full Throttle, at 37.
Wasn't the return of Demi Moore when she was, like, 45 and came out looking like she was, like, 20?
She looked insane. I still remember, like, being in a grocery store with my mom and, like, People magazine cover of Demi Moore, and was just like,
she's like getting out of the water.
She had like a better, yeah, exactly. It's like better body than any of the other three.
You were like, what the hell? Like,
Jesus Christ. Yeah. So Charlie's Angels and then The Hulk, 18 million. I think that was the Ang Lee one.
Yeah, right.
And then Finding Nemo, and it's like seventh week at 13. Yeah. So that brings us to the next question, which is, you kind of just mentioned it, and I'd mentioned it throughout the episode. Jacob Leaf at Jacob_Leaf, LIEF, tweeted us for our hashtag AMA question. This film was a shot in the arm for zombie films. What are some other action movies that reinvigorated their niche in the genre? And it doesn't have to be action movies. I think it'd be any movies. Ones that I thought of immediately were Knocked Up. I think Knocked Up really sure. kind of started this new type of millennial comedy
sure.
that you and I really, really relate to. I think Cabin in the Woods is really interesting for horror movies and like that campy style of horror movie. I had another one written down that I really thought was great.
I feel like I would probably say The Departed was one for
Ooh, that's
for
a very
its,
good
for
one.
Its time, because I think, you know, there hadn't been a really the last like really good crime movie had probably been Casino in 95, and it had been over 10 years since there had really been like a great, you know, Scorsese did it again.
Oh, Iron Man was the other one.
Iron Man, yeah, for that genre, that makes a lot of sense. I think those are solid. I think probably I'm thinking like in the animated genre. I mean, you had all the classic Disney stuff, and then you had
Maybe like Toy Story could be the one that was kind of like, we can switch over to this animation and we can still make the greatest movie. I mean, I don't know, because I'm trying to think of other movies that came out.
Top 50, Toy Story 1.
For sure.
It's in my top 50. Toy Story 1's unbelievable. It's so good.
Yeah, it's incredible, which is funny that Toy Story 3 is usually regarded as higher, which seems impossible. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other movies that kind of put shots in the arm. What about the action genre specifically? I mean, maybe The Rock, but it didn't really feel like it was just kind of one that happened during that time period.
I would say probably Taken would be.
That's a great example. Yeah, Taken is an excellent example.
08, because I think, you know, the mid-2000s, there was sort of action movies, but they weren't raw. Like Taken's pretty raw. It's pretty stripped down.
Yeah.
And Taken kind of was part of the modern era. I did a whole segment on Anchor about Redbox Generation, talking about what's happened sort of to various genres and movie stars. And I think Taken happened right at that time.
Yeah.
And Taken was sort of that low budget, what's Liam Neeson doing in this movie? We're going to release it as a theatrical release and see what happens. And it's just sort of like, yeah, well, you never know what's going to work. And this worked. Liam Neeson's an action star. And,
yeah,
I think that one was definitely
Taken's a really good example. That's a very good one.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on to critical reception, IMDb 7.6 seems about right.
Yep.
Rotten Tomatoes 87, 84, and 85% by all top and audience critics, which misses a little bit, but
all pretty similar, all pretty high.
Yeah, they're all similar, they're all high, and I think it's because of that third act. I think that's really what it is. So moving on to favorite line. Do you have a favorite line?
I do. I love when they're in the grocery store and Cillian Murphy's holding some like cheap bottle of whiskey, and Brendan Gleeson walks up and he's like, you know, don't do that. You can't just drink anything. And then he picks up a bottle of Lagavulin 16.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love Lagavulin 16.
You do love Lagavulin.
I'm a big fan of it. Yeah. I drink. It's like, that's like my, if I'm out to dinner with a group and everybody's drinking and I'm like, I'm going to have one drink and I'll be like, I'll get a Lagavulin 16 neat. Just because it's like
ooh.
Yeah, like it's sure. It's the common high-end scotch most places. If it's a good restaurant,
how much is that?
It.
Like 20-something bucks? 26
it depends
bucks?
Where you are. Usually 18.
That's
18,
not bad.
20 for something like that for a pour. It's like expensive, but like not...
Not ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like worth having one or two if you feel like splurging. Anyway, he picks up like six bottles of it. And he's like, ah, you can't just be drinking just anything. And he's like, takes out the fire, keeps the warmth.
Yeah.
Great. It's just because I just related to that. I was like, yeah, it's exactly right. He's like, nice peaty aftertaste. I was like,
we're drinking it right now.
The man knows what he likes.
My favorite line is not actually a line. It's the note that his parents leave him.
Oh, it's a great moment.
It's just so sad and like so sweet. Like, I remember I was watching with my mom and I went over. I was like, could you imagine that, having to tell me that you hope I die?
Yeah,
essentially, because the world's so bad,
right?
That, and so it's like, you know, we left you sleeping, now we're sleeping,
don't wake up.
It's not we hope you never wake up, it's don't wake up.
It's like sweet and real, but also like horror.
Yeah,
because it's like scary as shit.
It's
the idea
scary,
of reading that.
Like, yeah, and then like the scene is terrifying of like the parents in the bed that are like emaciated and dead. They've been there for a while, the nails are long, like it's just it's just something so cool about it. It's a perfect scene.
Yeah, it's a great scene. I had forgotten actually how much of this movie the soundtrack is that like sad symphonic sort of orchestral piano type of stuff. And it's just really like beautiful. It's just like this is a great movie. It's a really well balanced, really well put together movie. And it's really driven by strong relationships and strong characters.
Just the relationships.
Yeah, there's like no cheap scares and that stuff you're talking about. Don't go there. Don't turn the corner. Like none of that stuff's in this movie.
No, thank God.
It's a drama.
Really pull away. It is a drama. It's real.
It's a horror. It's like what it really feels like. This is like a horror action drama.
Like this is what would happen if this happened.
Yeah.
Which I think is perfect. It's a perfect segue to our question from Jonathan Gillian. At @basis_1996, which I don't know if I've seen. Have you seen this guy before?
I have, yep.
You have? Okay. Would you consider this one of the best horror movies of the past 20 years? I think that we've kind of said yes throughout this whole entire episode.
I think it probably is the best horror movie the last 20 years, yeah.
If I had to put other movies in that category, since I am such a big horror movie fan, if you guys want to check out, I love The Descent. It's phenomenal.
Jeepers Creepers.
I love Jeepers Creepers.
Did you watch Get Out yet?
I have not. My mom watched it. She was terrible.
Everybody just keeps telling me it was the best movie.
I know. You hated it? She hated it. Get Out. She said that it was so bad that her date wanted to leave during it,
and she
convinced him to stay. And I was telling her, I was like, she wanted to go to a movie yesterday. I was like, we could go to Kong or we could go to Get Out. And she's like, I do not want to see that at
She'd
all.
Already seen
she
it.
She was so over it.
She already went there with one date, Andrew. You're not going to get that one.
I'm not going to get that one. My other ones are The Descent, Cabin in the Woods, and Don't Breathe. Those three are so good, guys. If you have a chance, go watch those three horror movies. They're awesome.
I stay away from the genre for the most part, so it's a harder question for me to answer. But I think probably Let the Right One In was a really good one. I think I saw that. I like that one a lot. So anyway, we're going to move on to the last category here, which is there are three action movie categories: totally ridiculous, totally legitimate, ridiculously legitimate. We've explained them a lot of times. Legit are movies that are grounded, hold together, like The Fugitive, Lone Survivor.
You don't laugh unintentionally.
Movies that kind of fall apart and you just laugh the whole time, even though you think they're awesome. Con Air, Face Off, The Running Man,
Demolition Man, those are totally ridiculous.
And then you have Ridiculously Legitimate, which is the middle category. That's Point Break, that's The Rock, that's Predator. Mm-hmm. They're grounded in a couple really strong elements, maybe a strong performance, but overall, you do kind of laugh your way the whole way through. And I think this movie is totally legitimate.
Yeah.
I mean, the ending is the only part, but it wouldn't swing me too far.
Right, because it's not like crazy things happen. It's just kind of like, really?
Yeah.
I completely agree.
So we only have one movie left, one category left to talk about movies here, and that's called The Pitch. Whammy. Okay. We don't know what we're pitching.
We don't.
No.
We will do the classic poll.
We'll do the poll.
We'll put up a couple movies, and we'll let you guys decide. We'll try to think if there's anything relevant to kind of tie it to.
Yeah, AMA Podcast on Twitter, guys. If you go follow that, you'll see the poll. It'll go up today. And otherwise, thank you so much for watching, guys. Of course, follow us personally. I'm Ben Bateman Media. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram. And of course, please do check out Fist Pump Film Club on Anchor. It's Twitter meets podcasting, talking for 10 minutes every single day about movies. Download the app. It's 100% worth your time. And you can talk to me directly, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've actually been on there twice already, and it was super fun. We talked after Anacondas, and we talked after the Anaconda episode on AMA last week. So if you guys want to find me, you can find me at Andrew Guy on Instagram and Twitter. And thanks for showing up for my birthday. I appreciate
Happy
it.
Happy birthday, buddy.
Thank you, brother.
Thanks for witnessing the show, Supek. Thank you so
Bye,
much.
Bye, Mom. Bye, guys.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.